and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, former host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday, Leanne Hansen. Before retiring from radio in May, Hansen visited Anchorage and spoke to Alaska audiences as part of the APRN Speaker Series held at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on March 4th, 2011.
Good evening. My name is Steve Lindbeck. I'm the President and General Manager of Alaska Public Telecommunications, and I am just delighted to welcome you tonight to the APRN Speaker Series. Some of you have been to the other events in this series. This is the third in a four-part series that we're putting on this year to help support production of news in the Alaska Public Radio Network. And we have a very special guest tonight who I will introduce in a moment. With us from APTI is Pat Yak, our Vice President for Public Media. And then our special guest this evening is one who I think most of you know, perhaps have heard in your own bedrooms on Sunday mornings for many years. The Sunday host of Weekend Edition for NPR, Leanne Hansen.
Thank you. He had to bring up the bedroom thing, didn't he, right? No, I was telling some folks backstage, I was at another event and a gentleman came up to me and said, "I bet you don't recognize me with my clothes on." He takes his shower during Weekend Edition. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Leanne.
I love this guy. You are so lucky to have this guy. I've loved it, really, I mean. We did editor roundtables on Weekend Edition Sunday for quite a while, and Pat was always my favorite when I talked to him because he's just so down-to-earth and funny and real, and it was quite a disconnect to find out that he'd gone from Florida to Alaska and was in public radio. I thought maybe he had such a great time on Weekend Edition Sunday that he decided to make it his life's choice. Is that true?
Very close.
Very close. It's so nice to see you.
It's nice to see you.
Yeah.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you. I am so happy to be here. You have no idea. I'm having a ball.
Tell us about your ice skating this morning, because I know that was one of the things that we wanted to be able to do. We weren't sure the ice was going to be good enough.
I
understand you had a chance to get out this morning.
Yeah, when Pat sent the email to me inviting me to come up, he mentioned, because he knew I ice skated, and said we could arrange it. And so I had my skates, and I said, I'm going to pack them. I mean, much to the consternation of the TSA at National Airport. But nonetheless, I packed my skates, and there was a window of opportunity this morning. And I thought, and I had been shown the lagoon, and I haven't skated outside since I was a kid in New England. And I went out this morning and I laced up and I went out on, I mean, that ice in the lagoon is better than most of the rinks that I've skated. And then to see the Chugach Mountains in the distance while I was skating, this is, I mean, my feet began to hurt after, you know, not too many minutes, but it didn't matter. I persevered and I found I still can skate backwards and do some things like that. Yeah, yeah. Was doing the figure eight thing, you know, and all of that. And it's a memory that's going to stay in my mind forever as part of my Alaska experience. So it was fabulous.
That's
it was
great.
Just fabulous. I don't think I'd make the Olympic team, but I don't care. I had a great time.
You were telling us before we came out tonight that your dad had done some business in Alaska.
That's right.
Had come to Sitka.
Mm-hmm.
What were the stories that he told about coming out here to visit?
Well, it wasn't so much the stories, it was the pictures that he would bring back. My dad was a mechanical engineer who designed paper machines. And when I was young, I mean, I'm talking 5 years old, he would make regular trips to Sitka to troubleshoot some of the paper mills down there. And it was at an age where, I mean, really, he would take these, you know, 8mm films. He filmed the meal on the plane. He filmed out the window of the plane. And then, you know, showed a lot. And I would see, the onion domes. And, you know, to me, this was such, I always associated Alaska with my father. And my father passed away when I was 25. But I always had these memories and wanted to come and see Alaska for myself. And thanks to you all, I finally, I'm not seeing Sitka, that's fine. I'm in Alaska and I'm having a ball. And tomorrow I'm gonna do some flight seeing, and Sunday, that's a new term. I've never heard that term before, flight seeing. And I'll go up to Willow for the restart of the Iditarod. Yeah, I am, and I've got my camera with me, and believe me, I'm having just a ball. I mean, I still, every time I see the Chugach Range, you literally see me like this. I am in heaven. I feel like I'm in heaven.
You mentioned the Onion Dome, so it must be true that you can see Russia from here.
Oh. All right, now I'm going to correct you. I've looked at the map of Alaska, and I've seen Wasilla, and I've seen Russia. You cannot see Russia. But she didn't say that. That was Tina Fey who said that I can see Russia from my house. So, you know, you got to separate the joke from the reality, but, you know, close enough.
Well, let's talk about our governor for a moment. You've had the chance to interview our current governor when he first took office, but you've not had a chance to talk to our former governor, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. What would you ask her?
Why she wants to be in national politics? What makes her think she's qualified, first of all, to be in national politics? And frankly, what are I'm not interested in her. I'm interested in her ideas of governance, because I think politics has, in many respects, turned into a horse race. I mean, we always get criticized for reporting on the horse race aspects of any election. But frankly, that is what has been happening. It becomes an idea, I want to win. And that's not the end all of an election. There is, you have responsibilities once you are elected to govern. And I think, you know, we've gotten into this idea that, you know, I can go and be a winner, but that's not, I want to know, can you govern? Can you do the best you can for your community, for your state? And I just think it's she. I mean, you've had to live with her as a governor, and you know, how's that hopey changey thing doing for you, huh? I just think she's an interesting phenomenon, and I find it fascinating to kind of watch how the American people have responded to her, and I find it interesting now that she seems to have had presidential aspirations, that her poll numbers are starting to go down. So I think it's one of, it's, there's no there there. There's no depth there. It's not, I mean, elections are not beauty pageants. It's not the same thing. I mean, you are elected to serve your community, not to become a superstar. And that's, I find a little distasteful. Sorry.
Well, let's talk about interviewing for a moment, because your show has so many great interviews, and I was re-listening to the one you did with Ringo Starr the other day, and you alluded to the fact that when the Beatles broke onto the scene, that you were the target audience for them. You had a chance to talk about how he got his gig and about drumming and music and so forth. And how do you muster up the discipline to refrain from being a fan in situations like that and be a journalist?
I did an interview a long time ago with Anthony DeCurtis, who writes for Rolling Stone, who had, it was a collection of rock and roll interviews that he had done, you know, with many, many stars. And I asked him the question, that same question, how do you do an interview with someone that you're absolutely in awe of or have been a fan of for so long, but to do it to get information and you know, to serve your readers, or in my case, my listeners. And he gave me a great piece of advice. He said, get excited later. So, you know, this was an interview with a Beatle, and I was a Paul girl, but I'll take anyone that I can get. And he was a charming, no-nonsense guy. He really was. But I prepared so much for that interview. I mean, I prepared, I can't tell you how many hours I put into the preparation for an interview that lasted less than a half an hour, because I wanted to get the best from him. And I kept my cool during the interview. I had him sign a photograph that I actually sent to my son, because my son's a drummer, and I thought that he would love to have a photograph, Ringo signing a photograph of Connor, you know, playing the drums. And then I will tell you that after the interview's over and they closed the dressing room door where he was, I was in the hall doing my happy dance. And so that's what I do. I do my happy dance after the interview. I make sure I get something good on tape, and then I go crazy. I go home, I can't believe I talked to Ringo Starr, oh my God. But that's, you know, that's how you do it. You try to just swallow the awe. And you're talking to a person. I mean, yeah, he's a Beatle, he's a star, he's Ringo, but he's still a guy, just like, you know, the rest. And he probably has some really good stories to tell, and my job was to get him to tell those stories so that you could hear them.
So how do you invite people who have been interviewed so many times by so many people to open up like that? What makes for a good interview?
I think it's actually treating them as a person and not someone that's selling a product, and not letting them get away with the, you know, the publicity machine kind of answers. I mean, there's nothing worse than interviewing an author that repeats, as I say in my book, and it's not being afraid to ask the stupid question, you know, or a question that just occurs to you while you're talking to them. And it kind of gets a little bit disarming when you're not, you know, doing your standard publicity questions. You know, I want to know what it was like, you know, for you to be this. And his whole, I mean, Ringo, I'll go back to him. It had a lot to do with his childhood and his growing up. And I thought, these are stories that we haven't heard. And it's really just a matter of engaging them in conversation, looking them in the eye, and sometimes the best question is silence. You ask a question and they give you a bit of an answer and you just sit there. And nature abhors a vacuum, so they'll jump right in. Sometimes the best follow-up question is, really? What do you mean by that? And all of a sudden people realize that they're talking to a person too. You know, not somebody who's just there to get that 5 minutes to sell whatever product it is. The NPR experience is one where they know it's going to be in depth. They expect us to read the book. They expect us to know the music before we get into the interview. And I feel obliged to give them that kind of experience. So I treat them, even though if it's a star or like a playwright like Michael Frayn, you know, I saw his Noises Off in London and I was so admiring of him, and he came in, and again, it was just being able to talk to them person to person, not radio interviewer to star. I mean, it's that simple.
Do you remember much about the first one you did?
The first interview?
First interview for your show.
Oh, yes. Yes. Oy.
Is it a good memory?
No. It was my very, very first day on Weekend Edition Sunday, and my very first interview was with Jackie Leiden about the mayoral race in New York. And it was a live interview. And I did, you know, Jackie Leiden is in New York, Jackie, blah, blah, blah. And all I heard was, and it was, you know, technical difficulties. And I basically said, well, I was expecting some feedback on my first show, but I wasn't expecting it, you know, so soon. And, you know, the trick is, it's something I learned in theater. Something happens, you make a mistake, you keep going. You just keep going. And I kept going. 22 years I kept going. But that was the very first interview I did on the show, and it was just like, okay, I'm now prepared for anything.
You had Carol Simpson on the show, I think, last week.
A couple of weeks ago.
And you were talking about her challenge, or she was talking about her challenges of, mm-hmm. of coming into the field and mm-hmm. what it was like
being
for her.
Being a woman, being an African-American woman.
Did you have a similar experience?
Well, as a woman, people ask me what it was like as a woman in the 70s to be starting in public radio, because I, frankly, am a product of Title IX, as are Cokie Roberts and Susan Stamberg. It was, you know, time to get more women involved in broadcasting. I would say I had a harder time as a mother. My kids are now 30 and 28. and they were little when I was doing the show, and there wasn't a system or a structure in place that really helped women that had kids. I mean, I've had bosses that, if I had to go home because of an emergency, would say to me, "I'm tired of your kids ruining my program," and I said, "I'm tired of your program ruining my life." But there wasn't any kind. Telecommuting didn't exist. Job share didn't exist, and it was very difficult to try and raise my kids as well as do this program. And because I think of the path that people before me, Cokie Roberts and Susan, and myself, now we're about to move into the new building at NPR, and they are considering an on-site daycare. And this is a huge change. I mean, you know, our ladies' rooms have become, you know, people where the women can breastfeed or they can pump, and, you know, it's much more friendly now, family friendly, than it was when I started. And I think that was probably the hardest, not being a woman, but being a mother. But I also have, you know, you deal with the idea that people don't want to hear news from a woman because we don't have the gravitas. That's specious, you know. We do. We have the gravitas. Listen to this voice, baby. I got gravitas.
You're a Paul girl, huh?
I am. But I will admit to lying about that when I was in college and saying that I was a John girl, because it was much more hip to be a John girl than a Paul girl, but I was a Paul girl.
You mentioned Title IX, which reminds me of sports, which reminds me of Neil, who took some time off to be a baseball announcer. Have you ever had a chance to do something like that or wanted to do something like that?
Well, no, not in terms of minor league baseball play-by-play. I mean, I would love, you know, if I could get a part in a show, you know, that I could do for a year. That's my goal is to be on
stage. I think we could work that out for you.
Will you? Well, I'm on stage right now, and it's the most comfortable place in the world for me. I love being on stage, and that's something I hope to pursue after I leave my job, because you can't act if you're working on a Sunday, because you can't do the Saturday night show and you can't do the Sunday matinee. A friend of mine that I knew when I worked at Holy Cross College in the theater department actually became the head of the Washington Stage Guild. And he kept telling me, you know, "I really want to do Mrs. Warren's profession, you know, with you," because their specialty was Shaw. And I said, "I'd love to do it, but they're not going to give me the time that it would take to rehearse and actually do the show." So the Possum Community Players in Georgetown, Delaware, look out.
We asked people before you came, Leanne, if they had some questions, and mm-hmm. one of the emails was that they wanted to know, that they said they loved that Will Shorts and the Puzzler and that element of the show, and this person wanted to know if you were a devotee of the New York Times puzzles as well. Are you a crossword puzzler?
I do. I like to do the crossword puzzles. I do really well on Monday. And I do fairly well on Tuesday. By Wednesday, I'm fading. By Thursday, it's fading even more. I've only completed one Friday in the entire time, never completed a Saturday. But on Sunday, I have the New York Times Magazine with me, and at 8:00, I open it up to the Sunday crossword puzzle. And I actually have it by my side on the air. And my goal is to see if I can finish it by the end of the show. And I've succeeded a couple of times. I broke my personal best, I think, is East Coast time, 9:10, about 9:15. It was a pretty easy puzzle. But if I haven't finished the puzzle by 10:00, when the first feed is finished, then I just put it aside and that's it. Although ideas will come to me and I'll go back and start to do something. But I enjoy it. I think it's fun. It helps my vocabulary. It helps my knowledge of useless information.
That's where your gravitas comes from.
That's where my gravitas comes from, the useless information that I carry in my head.
Had that been an element of the show before you had come along, or is that something
yes,
that you had introduced?
Yes, it was. Okay. When Susan Stamberg started the show, the vision for the show was really like your Sunday newspaper, where there was you'd get the headline news, and there would be an opinion page, and I mean, I was determined to get humor into the show somewhere so you could get your funnies. But the puzzle. And Susan wanted Richard Maltby to come on board and do the puzzle segment. But he was busy and recommended a young editor at Games Magazine who happened to be Will Shortz. So in the first year or so of the program, Will would appear occasionally and do a puzzle with Susan. And when I came on board, I just thought, here's a place where the show can be interactive, where we can get our listeners involved and get our member, you know, get member stations some, give them some props. And that was, I think, what turned the show around. People began to tune into the puzzle segment, which is only a 7.5 minute segment mostly, and then gradually began to listen to the rest of the program. So puzzle got people into the tent. And now our average listening time, which is rather unusual, is 1.25 hours for Sunday morning, which is amazing. But it was puzzle that gradually, because we only had about 200,000 listeners and falling when I started the show, and now we have about 3.5 million people who listen to the program. So. And Will, you know, Will is getting fame from it. I mean, you know, yeah, he's the crossword editor for the New York Times, but please, you know. Who made him what he is today?
I was looking at a list of the musicians that you've had on the show. Peter Gabriel, Loretta Lynn, Marianne Faithfull, Bruce Hornsby, John Mayer, Jimmy Webb, one of my favorites, Roger Daltrey.
Mm-hmm. Jimmy Webb was one of my favorites too. I got
why
to
is that?
Him twice.
Why is that?
Well,
I mean,
because he's a writer, and his songs have been done by so many people, and he had actually written a book on the writing that he had done. And then he did this album where people were redoing some of his favorite songs. And he's a wonderful interview. He's somebody who liked to tell stories and liked to be able to talk about his career, and it was a pleasure to be able to interview him. It's difficult because there are some disciplines, and music can be one of them, dance, sculpture, photography, you know, where an artist, that's how they express themselves. And to ask them to express themselves in words in an interview is sometimes very difficult to do. And I do find that people who have had teaching experience are often better interviewers because they know how to talk about what they do. There are some artists that's very difficult for them to talk about what they do. Mark Morris, the choreographer, I did an interview with him, and I asked him a question, and he basically said, go look at it, you'll see it. And I said, well, that's not gonna help me. But it is interesting. But the music on the show, I mean, that is something. We were the first show broadcast in stereo, and we thought we should take advantage of that. And I had just come off a stint on Performance Today, where I had done interviews and within a performance of musicians, and I wanted to bring this idea to Weekend Edition Sunday and got a lot of resistance for it because, you know, what was a performance chat doing in a news magazine program? And I said, no, it's a news magazine program. And it turned out, I will be honest with you, the music features do not get a lot of respect within NPR because they're focused on the news, but among the listeners, the music is something that has become a signature of our show. And when I did the interview a few weeks ago with Kurt Elling and Don Was, a producer and a recording artist, before we began the interview, he said to me, I want to thank you for all the music and the musicians that you've put on the air. And to hear it from someone like that, you know, and I think you have to have that, particularly on a Sunday, because Sunday is a different, you listen differently on Sunday because of where you are and what you're doing. We slow things down a little bit and we can let things run a little longer. And we are, you know, I still find myself fighting for time for some of our music interviews, but I prevail.
So I can see why.
Yeah, right.
I can understand some of the big name people that I just talked about, but you've also had performers and composers, one of whom I had a chance to see as she was rising was a young violinist named Hilary Hahn.
Hilary Hahn, absolutely.
Who has made a big name for herself. Mm-hmm. So explain why you have also on the show these up-and-comers that maybe some other folks have not have heard of.
That, for exactly that reason. There are a lot of stars that get all the kinds of publicity and the breaks that, you know, They don't need me. I mean, I have turned down Justin Bieber, and I've turned down Madonna. What else is there to say, really, you know? But my interest has always been the novelist with the first novel, or the musician with the first recording. Ben Folds, who became, you know, pretty important, he sent me a cassette in the mail of his music, and I heard something in there, and I thought, come on in for an interview. And it gave him the break that he needed to rise up. Novelists, Edwidge Dantacott, Khalid Hosseini, who wrote The Kite Runner, I did his first interview. Samuel L. Jackson, I did his first radio interview. And I'd like to be able to give people a break, because we have this machine in our popular culture that promotes certain people, and other people don't get a chance to be heard. And I thought, give me the small label with the new artists so that you can hear them at the beginning. And I will tell you, I mean, that's one thing I'm very proud of in the 22 years I've been doing it, that I've been able to give artists a living, you know, a chance to actually make a living and, you know, boost their careers. And but David Letterman listens to my show. And I know this because I have done some new people like Vienna Tang, Diane Birch, and they show up on his show 3 weeks later because he heard the artist on my air. And there was also a time where he interviewed Will Shortz on his show. It was just, he had Paris Hilton on the same show. I can't imagine what the green room was like. And he said, the first thing he said to me, this isn't about music, you'll forgive me, but he said, you do that puzzle with on Weekend Sunday on NPR with Leanne Hansen. I just want to tell you, she's too nice, you know? She's too nice to these people. I mean, she should really be saying, you're too stupid to be playing puzzle. No lapel pin for you, you know? But I'm sitting there with my jaw open going, David Letterman just said my name. So it's very interesting that people, they will listen to what we put on the air now to hear what is coming up. I've got a singer coming up. I did the interview because she was only available last week, and her CD won't come out until probably June. And a wonderful singer. I mean, she will remind you of Karen Carpenter in terms of the beauty of the tone of her voice. Beautiful singer, wonderful songs. I guarantee you Letterman's going to have her on 3 weeks after I put her on the air. But that's, I think those are the people that need the attention. We don't need the people that are already getting all the attention. Let's shine the light on the people who are talented but can't get a break. And I'm going to give them a break with a national audience. And you all will respond. I've made my mistakes, big ass truck. I've made my mistakes. But, you know, usually it's pretty good. And I also have a team of people that love music, and they may like different music from music that I would listen to regularly, but their passion makes me passionate about the music, and then at that point my job is to execute their idea. And so I've also been introduced to a lot of music that I probably wouldn't know because of the people on my staff.
So play along with me here for a moment. Let's say you and I were throwing a dinner party.
Right.
Who would you like to have play at it?
Well, Yo-Yo Ma.
Speaking of someone who's never been heard of.
Right, I know. Who would I? Oh,
maybe James Taylor and Yo-Yo Ma.
Right. I mean, I would love Ben Clyburn to play. I mean, I'm going to aim high here, right? I would love, you know, Bill Charlap to come and play piano. I'd like to get Dr. John in there, you know. I mean, can I have several different kinds
of
music, you know? I mean, give me some good old soul. Yeah. I mean, if Solomon Burke was still alive, he'd be performing at my dinner party. Wilson Pickett would, that's the music that I love, good old soul music, you know, something.
Sam and Dave. Dance to.
Oh, in a New York minute, you know, Sam and Dave.
Sam and Dave.
You bet. And I was very... I felt very fortunate to be able to do one of Solomon Burke's last interviews before he died. And it was a treat to finally talk to this amazing soul singer. And he was such a delight to talk to. So,
you've talked to so many unbelievable people and so many unbelievable places. And again, in having the chance to visit with you, I went back and listened to the interview you did with Anne Rice at her home in New Orleans.
In New Orleans, in the Garden District.
And you had a chance to talk to her about the ghosts and spirits at her own house. So what was that like, to be sitting with the Queen of Vampire novels and talking about ghosts at her house in New Orleans?
First coming into the house, she had this beautiful home in the Garden District of New Orleans. And because it informed so much of her writings, I really wanted to interview her in the place where she did the work. But it was at a time when she had just done, I interviewed her for her last vampire novel, because she was moving into this new era, this new area that she's exploring in terms of Christianity. And it was an interesting transition. And for her to go from, the undead to the risen, frankly. And but to be in that house and for her to show me around and to see the desk where she does her writing and to be in New Orleans, which has this atmosphere of, you get a sense that there is another dimension that is there. And that was my first trip to New Orleans as well. And so I was, kind of absorbing what she had lived with most of her, and she was a treat to talk to, a real treat to talk to. And I've talked to her subsequently, and of course I was when Hurricane Katrina hit and, the Garden District was hit, not as badly as the Ninth Ward, but I had had a sense already of what it was like to live there. And I was intimidated. When I get intimidated, I just do more research. I read, I absorb as much information as I can, and then I distill it into, a series of questions in hopes. And she's a storyteller, so she was interested. But to be in her house and, with the moss hanging off, you could practically see Lestat, in the background somewhere.
Did you do any body checks when you got home?
Nope, I didn't do any body checks when I got home. And I didn't see any ghosts either. So.
We have a microphone over here in this corner, so if you'd like to ask Leanne some questions, we're going to have some time, so please make your way to the mic.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Leanne Hansen, former host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday. Leanne was recorded at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium in Anchorage, where she sat down for an on-stage conversation with APTI's Pat Yak as part of the APRN Speaker Series held on March 4th, 2011. Following the interview, Leanne responded to questions from audience members.
I just want to know the feeling at NPR about what's going on in the House of Representatives as far as the budget bill and wanting to cut funding for NPR, and I just wanted to know the feeling there at the station and what could be done about it from all of us.
Yes, of course, everybody is very concerned because, cutting funding to public radio once again has become, the darling, just as it was in 94 and 95. The thing is, people do not understand what NPR is. And because we are now a respected member of the media and we are a large organization, it is thought that we work the same way that the major networks do, and that's not the case. And you have to remember the reason the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was founded is to create an outlet for broadcasting without interference from either the government or commercial interests. That is the core of what we are about. But we are seen as, the counterculture, the liberal left, and all of our stations are on the left-hand side of the dial, but that doesn't mean that's what our politics are. But public radio also began during the Vietnam War, at a time when there was a culture clash going on, and it's a culture clash that still exists to this day, except we've grown up. And we become a very easy target. I think that if some people did not have NPR to demonize, then they wouldn't have anything to talk about it. You can't, they need somebody to demonize. But as far as funding goes, I'm telling people there are a lot of closet public broadcasting supporters, some that can't admit to their fellow politicians that they actually listen to public radio. There is a fringe element, but in the Senate, I think you'll find that I'm just hoping that the same thing will happen, that I know we have support in the Senate. I know senators, I've spoken to them and I've said, well, I can't say this, but you know, you enjoyed this interview. Please remember that when the vote comes up. It is a frightening thing because it's become, you know, the fireworks, and it's a way to get attention. And for the commercial networks that are going after us, it increases their revenue because the fireworks go and they get the eyeballs and they get the advertising revenue. We don't benefit from this at all, and we're not actually, you know, attacking the other side. We're an easy target, and I think what public radio and public television, what it really means to this country, I think by the time the bill gets to the Senate, I think you'll find that there will be more support there. I mean, I've been through this before. I mean, I've been through the 94, and I think the worst time I've been through was 83, when they had the crisis, the funding crisis. I mean, I was pregnant with my second child, and I had a toddler, and I was on a plane on our way to Heathrow for Neil to be the London correspondent, and we were literally in the air when the board was meeting to decide whether NPR would exist when we landed. When I was moving our apartment in New York, the Santini brothers were packing up the boxes, and one guy came to me and said, who's paying for this? And I said, National Public Radio, my husband. And he dropped the box, and he said, ain't they going down to tubes? Well, here we are how many years later, and I think it's your voices that make a difference, the individual constituents that say, we support public broadcasting, and I think you will find that there are a lot more people that support public radio and television that are not saying anything about it. This has been the case. Newt Gingrich is a listener. He is. He's admitted. He gets his news from National Public Radio. All right, so it's a little weird for him to come around and say that we shouldn't be there. So I think, I mean, I'm hopeful. You never know what's going to happen, but I'm hopeful that, you know, your voices are going to be heard, and that's what is needed. And it's scary. Yeah, it's a little bit scary. It's scary. It's scary for the smaller stations, certainly, because they are the ones that rely on those government funds to be able to procure the programming that we provide, the national programming that we provide. The stations are the ones that are going to lose out, and it's a shame. But I think there's total misinformation that's getting out there about what public radio really is, what the structure is. I mean, we don't tell our member stations what to program. They program according to the community. And what we are really are a lot of individual communities that are linked together. And again, it's trying to get the truth out there about what public broadcasting does. And what do we do with the money that we get? We buy bulletproof vests for our reporters. We buy helmets. We get drivers and fixers. We hire journalists in Iraq and in other places where news is happening. That's how we spend our money. So all we can do is keep hitting that bell and keep trying to get that truth out there. And you know what public broadcasting means in your life. So it's very important for you to tell the people that have the votes. I will tell you, though, I did an interview with Senator Barbara Mikulski a few weeks ago. She's the longest serving woman in the Senate. And unbeknownst to everybody else, she has these occasional dinners with other senators, including Lisa Murkowski. And they because they each have in common energy issues, they get together behind the scenes. And so it's not like a food fight. They actually discuss the issues. And that makes me very optimistic about the way that the Senate works. It's not just what you see, the grandstanding that you see on C-SPAN, but there's a lot of behind the scenes work that goes on. And I think that behind the scenes work will be to our benefit. I can only hope. But I'm optimistic.
Yes, sir.
We love NPR.
Yay.
About 20 years ago or so, I was in Oak Park, Illinois, and I was taking the tour of the Frank Lloyd Wright houses, and there was a woman on the thing that, and
they're
it was,
still using
of all
it?
Things, it was Lee Ann Hansen.
Oh, that was before I was hired for NPR. I mean, I was trying to freelance and you know, and they invited me. I knew the guy that ran Acoustiguide, who does these museum tours. That when you go to a museum, you take the tour. And I was making ends meet by writing and recording these tours. And one of the ones I got to do was the one for the Frank Lloyd Wright houses in Oak Park, Illinois. And I did not know that they're still using it. Oh, you'll get to hear my baby princess voice if you didn't have to go there, because it was recorded 30 years ago.
Yeah, great.
Oh, so funny. Oh, my God. It always will come back. Anything on tape, it's going to come back to haunt me. Yes,
hi.
Sir.
Can you describe what it's like to make the show? And what's your week like
sure.
when you're...
It's unbeknownst... I mean, you know, no, I do not work only on Sundays for 2 hours. It is a full week. We prepare for the coming week's show, and we also are doing interviews anticipating shows coming up in the future. Our day begins, our week begins on Wednesdays, where we usually start the week with a meeting about where the news is going, how the network is covering it, what is likely to be the news on Sunday, although you can't really predict. But we can also, we know things are happening. For example, we knew the National Governors Association were having their winter meeting in Washington, so we went after a governor, Chris Gregoire, actually, of Washington State, did the interview with us. We had done an interview with her before. She's a friend of the program. But knowing that that was coming up, putting all the wheel, everything in motion to make sure we had that interview for that weekend, we knew the Future Farmers of America, where they're not called that anymore, they're called the FFA organization, but we knew that they had just had their convention. We had done an interview with Tom Vilsack, the Department of in Agriculture, so we wanted to talk to some of the young folks. So there's long-range planning. There's what's coming up this week. I know when I go back to work next Thursday, I'm doing an interview with musicians that have done this thing called the Baseball Project, and they do all this music. They write all these original music about baseball and pitchers, and I know we're going to play that close to opening day. So there's a lot of future planning. We have futures meetings on Thursdays. You know, the week begins to build up to the point where it's Friday and Saturday and things begin to get, you know, cemented in. I know that I'll be doing a live interview with Mara, that I'll be doing an interview with, say, you know, Peter Kenyon in Cairo, or we think we're going to get someone from Libya. It's every week, it's like Groundhog Day. we start from scratch, and what do we have for this week? What do we need for this week? What's going to happen this week? And then sometimes on a Saturday, all that can be blown out of the water. The most recent example of that, obviously everything that's happening in the Middle East is an example of that. But the Arizona Congresswoman's shooting happened at 1:30 Eastern time, which is a half an hour before Scott's show ends. And then we knew that the coverage would continue through Sunday, so we had to drop some things that we had already planned in order to accommodate that sort of news. I've had shows that we had all set, you know, on Saturday night, and then I wake up in the morning and it looks like they've captured Saddam Hussein, so what we had planned for those 2 hours becomes 6-hour live coverage so that we respond. So you know, it is, and then we also will go places, you know, to do reporting and then come back and do the show. We plan trips as well. So it's more than a full week. And then I spend my spare time reading what I need to read, making sure I'm keeping up with how stories are moving, and knowing if I'm going to be talking about this subject, you know, reading as much as I can. So it's a full week at, or more. So.
Yes.
If you had the chance to interview anybody who is a resident of Wisconsin, although not necessarily in Wisconsin, who would it be and what questions would you ask him or her?
Actually, my best friend's partner is a state worker in Madison. And so there's a little conflict there. I can't interview, you know, my friend's partner, but I'm dying to find out what's going on from him as being a state worker. So actually, you know, he's the one I would want to interview right now, but I'm not going to be able to. So yeah, isn't that interesting what's happening in Madison? But it's also interesting to talk to Chris Gregoire, who has similar budget problems in Washington State, and how she's avoided what's happened in Wisconsin. And basically, it's about sitting down at a table and having a civil discussion about the issues and making the hard choices, but doing it collaboratively rather than by dictate. So.
Anyone else? We have I think we can get a mic down here.
I was wondering what you thought of what was going on in Egypt, because it wasn't that long ago that I remember you were there,
right?
And you were in that big slum, and you
yes.
And what do you think of what's happening now? And
it's amazing.
Do you have any contact with anyone there?
Yes, we still are. We've been in contact with the woman that we called, who was our fixer, when we were in Washington, in Cairo. And Hana, who was the Copt Christian who lived in the Zabayin, where the garbage collectors are. And when we were there in 2008, there were already rumblings of discontent. I mean, major rumblings. It was there were demonstrations, but there were it was because of bread prices, and they were called the bread riots. And you know, you got a sense of this dissatisfaction with the current government. But it was curious to be in the poorest of the poor neighborhoods at a time when bread was at a premium, to walk through the neighborhood and people come out and offer us the bread that they had. And, you know, the people of Egypt are just amazing. I mean, they are extraordinarily hospitable. We were in the cop section, we were in the old Muslim city, but to a person, you know, they were just very welcoming, but you could sense the sense of dissatisfaction. There were already sporadic demonstrations, but they were cracked down on while we were there. And so to see this happen in Cairo, I mean, of course, my concern was, you know, how are, you know, the poorest of the poor being treated, you know, what's happening, are they in the demonstrations? And then to watch actually, you know, this regime come down after 42 years and the, you know, elation of the people that they were finally going to have a say in the way that they were governed. We were just getting a little sense of that when we were there in 2008, but it bloomed full. After, I think, what happened in Tunisia, you know, there was a certain sense that of the people being empowered, you know, to be able to say, we're not going to take this anymore. And I was very concerned. I'd been in Alexandria as well. And I was not only concerned for the people, but there's a concern about, you know, there is a heritage there. And there is a history there. And I was just hoping that it wasn't going to be destroyed. I mean, you look at what's happening with Libya right now. And the fear is, I mean, it's just going to dissolve into a civil war that's going to claim, you know, quite a few lives, and that's very hard to watch. But yes, we were immediately calling our friends or emailing them to make sure that, you know, everybody was okay.
I think we have time for one more question. Thank you.
Well, I don't have a real heavy question, but I'm very curious about your background before you started the Sunday edition, because you mentioned drama.
Yes.
But is journalism also part of that, or history?
No, and neither was radio. My best friend, whom I mentioned, lives in Wisconsin. We met at the University of Hartford, and she did shifts at the radio station, so I would hang out at the campus radio station, but it never occurred to me that this was something that I wanted to do. I was in the theater department. I wanted to be an actress, and I moved to Binghamton basically to get out of Worcester, Massachusetts. You know, sometimes you gotta leave your hometown, whatever reason. And I acted in community theater there, but I had found a job as an assistant to the development director of the television station. And they were putting their radio station on the air in 1975, and the woman they hired to do the morning show was a single mom and couldn't get up that early to go, you know, I'm willing to do the shifts other people don't want to do. So he said, you have a good voice, have you ever considered it? And I said, and give up typing? And so I it was one of these things where I learned how to do it within 24 hours because you had to run the board. I didn't know how to cut tape. I learned how to do it, and I just ran with it, and I ended up running with it for the rest of my career. And I found that there's a performance aspect to being in radio, which I, you know, enjoy, but there's the heart of an actress still beats within me, and I'm hoping to get a chance to express myself in that way soon. So, no, I had to learn how to be a journalist, and I had to learn. You talk about mistakes. One of the first interviews as I was working in Binghamton was with the Speaker of the State Senate, and he was coming into Binghamton, and so I drove up to the airport to do the interview with him and got a good interview, got back to the station and realized that the pause button was still on my tape recorder, so nothing recorded. And I knew he was there for lunch, and I knew he'd be flying out later in the afternoon, and I knew I needed the story for the morning, so I went back up to the airport, waited till he came back, explained the situation to him, and he gave me another interview, and I always checked that pause button from then on.
Hi, welcome to Alaska.
Thank you.
So, who would you like to interview before you leave your post? Say, who's on your bucket list?
On my
bucket list. Top five, maybe.
Well, I wanted to do an interview with Judi Dench. Right, because she has a autobiography, but it just never worked out. And actually, when I lived in England, I lived around the corner from her. And so I would see her all the time with her late husband, Michael. And I saw a lot of productions when I was in London, and just amazed because she's such a fabulous actress. I thought she would be a wonderful interview, but it didn't quite work out. So I got Derek Jacobi. You know, it's fine. I have to say that was an interview of a lifetime. I honestly can't. I mean, I just feel like I've interviewed so many interesting people. There's not one person. I mean, you know, I have my people I love, like, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Stephen Sondheim and people like that, but they've done interviews, and I'm not quite sure if I would really, you know, get anything. I'm hoping to go back to some of the people that I interviewed early on. There's one gentleman who wrote a book about being a country doctor in Maine, and curiously enough, he just got back in touch with me, and I would love to be able to go back and check up on some of the people that I interviewed, you know, 20 years ago, to see where they are now in their lives. So that's what I'm interested in, not any kind of, you know, star factor. I want to, I'll tell you, one person I would love to talk to is Scott Hamilton. I just think he's an amazing person, athlete, what he's done for the sport, what he's done for everything. I'm not sure I'm going to get that chance, but I sure would love to.
Hi.
22 years ago, we moved into our house, and so you have been a tradition of our Sunday mornings for 22 years. Mm-hmm. And so thank you for that.
Well, thank you for listening.
And then the other part is, what is your favorite weekend tradition?
Since you've been a big
weekend tradition? Since you've been our weekend tradition for 22 years.
Oh, all right. I will tell you. You need the backstory before I tell you what we do. Before Scott goes on the air on Saturdays, he gets on the intercom at the headquarters and says, "It's a beautiful day for a radio program. Let's do two today." You know, so that goes over, and then he does the show. So we developed a tradition that at the end of every show on Sunday, we have a piece of tape from the Larry Sanders Show, and it's ripped torn, saying, "Delightful, delightful, this is the best show we've ever done." And sometimes very creative producers will string together like a series of little sound bites from the guests that have been on that particular show to create like this other kind of sentence that, you know, it's like they'll take my bloopers, or, you know, if I've you know, said something on mic as I'm recording and I've made a mistake, or they'll take a part of an interview, and it's just, you know, hysterical what they will do with it. But that is our tradition, and I will not leave the control room until Rip Torn tells me it's the best show we've ever done.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Leanne Hansen, former host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday. Before retiring from NPR in May, Leanne traveled to Anchorage and spoke at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium as part of the APRN Speaker Series on March 4th, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our new website, alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.